Real or artificial? That's the question you may be asking yourself this year if you're in the market for a Christmas tree. And it's one of the items we'll address during this edition of On Your Money. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Tuesday, November the 15th. Certified financial planner Kevin McKinley is back this week. And besides some money news about Christmas trees, he'll have tips on whether it's worth it or not to get an extended warranty on those electronics that you might be getting as gifts, and things that we can do between now and the end of the year to save on taxes, plus answers to your personal finance questions at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Madison and Eau Claire, and he joins us from our studios in Eau Claire. Ho, 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 Kevin.
Good morning, Joy, and happy holiday tidings, seasons, greetings to you.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. It's a little bit early, but this is the time that some of us are thinking of going out to the Christmas tree lot or to the department store to buy Christmas trees, and Christmas trees are in the news these days.
That's right. We are less than 40 days away from December 25th, and I just noticed my children have a way of finding this out even before, I think, it hits the general public, but The Grinch Who Stole Christmas was already broadcast on TBS or one of the other cable stations. So
that is a little early.
It is a little early, but it seems to get earlier every single year. Actually, right now, we are buying gifts and decorating for next Christmas in 2012.
You are prepared.
We are ready for it. That's right. We're less than 40 days away from December 25th, and the Christmas tree, of course, is one of the first things many people, not everyone, but many people, have to think about when they're getting their holiday plans together. The Christmas tree was actually, as we came to know it, has its origins in Germany in the 16th century, and it didn't come to the United States until the middle 1800s, and even then it was looked down upon and as almost a pagan symbol. But of course, it's come to become a symbol for Christmas, as the beautiful tinkling piano music from the Peanuts show delineates here. We actually buy about 35 million Christmas trees per year. About three quarters of those are pre-cut, and a quarter of those cut themselves of the live ones, and about three out of four are real trees versus the artificial trees. Wisconsin is a very big player in the real Christmas tree business. We have about 200 farms that currently have about 11 million trees planted, and they sell about a million per year. Of course, there's a lot of discussion about the real versus artificial trees. That's a subject of passion in many different families. And then, as dictated by law that I apparently missed, but Christmas trees, like every other issue and subject, have to have some political connotation to be beaten back and forth.
Well, yeah, there was the Christmas trees became a political football last week.
It's a battlefield, excuse me, in the war on Christmas, and it's understandable. There was a recent story about the governor actually delineating the Christmas tree, saying, no, this is a Christmas tree that we have here in the Capitol. And that helped commerce and business quite a bit, because every single newspaper or media website that published that story, that was immediately the most commented story. And I'm really glad that a lot of people have the time and interest on their hands to comment on and go back and forth on this very important issue. More kind of germane to the political and economic situation is there was a story about a tree tax, which wasn't really a tax, but you know those campaigns like the Got Milk and Beef, It's What's for Dinner,
that's
and
right.
all those?
Something okay. paid for that.
That's right. The National Christmas Tree Growers Association wanted to get a 15% fee on every tree sold and have that go into a general fund that would then promote real Christmas trees as a viable alternative to artificial trees. That came to a great deal of political backlash. It was going to raise about $2 million or so, but it was viewed as a tax on small growers. And so now, because it was going to go through the White House, it got stuck on President Obama, and now it's been postponed.
Yeah, he postponed it. But this was something that I thought the industry wanted, because they wanted that promotional effort.
Right, and 15 cents is affordable for most people, but it was the idea that the government was getting involved with it rather than the Tree Growers Association deciding to do it or not to do it. And, of course, you get free riding. If some people decide to fund the campaign, other growers say, I don't want to pay for it, they ostensibly benefit for it, so they were trying to get some kind of dictation, and there was precedent set for it, but a lot of people said, you know, why does the government need to get involved in this?
Yeah. So where do you stand on the real versus artificial Christmas tree issue?
Well, ironically, it's about the romanticism of Christmas and all that it comes about with the holiday and the reality. If you're a romantic, you like real trees. And the reality is you tend to lean towards fake trees. You know, the real trees have tradition, the family, the atmosphere with the pine smell and the thing tipping over in the living room.
Starting on fire.
No, actually, we have a new campaign that actually didn't need to be, no government involvement in this whatsoever. A wet tree is a safe tree.
There we go.
So when we've had real trees in the past, I just stand there with a garden hose in the living room and keep hosing the thing down, much like people in California do on their roofs if there's a wildfire approaching. But no, the artificial trees, ironically enough, those are generally found in the homes of people who are older, who don't have small children. And people with small children who are younger still have that romantic view of Christmas. They want the real trees. So again, there are some safety issues, but as long as you keep the tree watered every single day and you turn off the lights before you go to bed, I don't advocate the romantic nature of putting individual candles on the tree. I don't think that's a good idea, even it might be a tradition whatsoever. What I'd really like to see, rather than a 15-cent tree tax, is I'd like to see the growers get together and actually just drop off the real tree, set the thing up so it stands up perfectly straight in my living room, and then I want you there on later in the afternoon on December 25th. I not only want you to clean up the tree, but clean up all the paper underneath, throw it in a big bin, compost it back out, and I think that would really improve the sales of live trees.
There you go. There's your solution. You know, I've never had an artificial tree. And I guess I was a fan of the real tree through most of my childhood and my adult life too. But we stopped even putting up a tree. We don't have kids, so Christmas morning's not a huge deal for us with presents under the tree. But when we had cats, and three of them, it was a bad idea.
Well, and I like to add a little edge to it. I mean, yes, you can go to one of the many cut-your-own farms, or you can get a tree on the lot. But it's more fun to get up, you know, get the kids up in the middle of the night and go out to, you know, a local park or a golf course and create a little sense of danger. You get a better sense of trees out there. And I think it's more fun, and it's the true meaning of giving, to have those people give their trees to us.
We're going to be talking about a number of other issues besides Christmas trees. But if you want to weigh in on the real versus fake Christmas tree issue, you can do that. Or if you have a question for Kevin, 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Kevin McKinley is the managing member of McKinley Money LLC, a registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. Kevin does not intend to provide personalized investment advice through this broadcast and does not represent that the securities or services discussed are suitable for any investor. Investors should consult with their financial advisors prior to making any investment decisions. And it is time now for the On Your Money email bag. And Sherry says, my husband is on Social Security and we will be receiving a few thousand dollars in an inheritance from his brother. Will there be federal or Wisconsin tax on this money? Do you know, Kevin, if this will affect his Social Security check?
It's unlikely that inheritors will pay any tax on money received in this nature. The current law on a federal basis is it's $5 million of an estate are free from estate taxes, and generally amounts over that are taxed at a rate of 35%. Wisconsin currently has no estate tax in place, but there are always some provisions in place to have that come back into play. So for the time being, though, there's no estate tax for Wisconsin residents, and there are only a few instances that someone would receive money as an inheritance and have to pay any taxes at all.
Like what?
Well, they might have to pay income taxes on a couple types of accounts. Like if, let's say, someone leaves an IRA or a 401k to a beneficiary, or they have an annuity, that money was going to be taxed anyway. And generally, it's just a matter of if, not or rather when, but not if. So the money's going to be taxed when it comes out, but it is only taxed when it comes out, and it's only on the gains, especially in the case of an annuity. So an inheritor of an IRA or an annuity can choose several different steps from how to pull that money out and help mitigate the taxes for it. And again, technically it is taxable, but it's only ordinary income. So many people do not have an ordinary income tax applied to them, so they don't have to pay taxes on it, even if it is taxable.
Okay, so it sounds like Sherry's husband probably won't owe estate taxes on this money, but will it affect his Social Security check?
Again, unless it's an IRA or an annuity, probably not. It's not income. It's an inheritance. So it's not added to the formula that determines if Social Security is taxable. And even if it is, it's a relatively small amount, and it's only going to occur in 1 year. So it's highly unlikely that he'll pay any tax at all. And if he does, the bill should be relatively small.
We will take your calls for Kevin McKinley at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. In just a moment, Kevin is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money LLC with offices in Eau Claire and Madison. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
The best things in life are free, but you can give them to the birds and bees. I want money.
This is On Your Money. I'm Joy Cardine along with Kevin McKinley. Coming up a little bit later in the program, we will share five things that you can do to save money on your taxes or the taxes that you will owe next April, and we will take your calls for Kevin now, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Our first caller is Sue in Mequon. Hi, Sue.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering about IRAs for husbands and wives and if they should have the same investments in each in case of, like, a divorce. You know, what happens to those assets? Are they each individual? Am I making myself clear?
You are making yourself extremely clear, Sue, and it is a common issue I see with couples, and where typically one member of the couple, often the male in a stereotypical couple, feels that, hey, we're okay, we can be wildly aggressive, and it's all going to be okay, and oftentimes the female in the couple says, you know what, I'm really, this makes me nervous, and I feel terrible when I check the portfolio, especially in this last quarter ending September 30th, and I see we've lost, you know, 20-30% of our money. That really makes me nervous. And so in the instance of splitting things up for a divorce, yes, I do believe that it is better to have a balanced portfolio between couples. But most couples don't get divorced and don't split up. And if they do, the allocation of their assets is generally not the biggest issue, even on a financial basis. So I would prefer in a couple that one member who is more aggressive and feels very confident in his or her strategies and where the money is put, that he or she goes aggressive. And the one who is less aggressive says, look, I'm just going to invest this more conservatively and not lose the money. And I think it's perfectly fine to go to invest kind of on an individual basis what's most comfortable for you, rather than trying to mold two extremely different personalities. That it's hard enough in a marriage to do that. It's worse when you're trying to do it with money, because that adds an extra source of tension.
Very good. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much, Sue. Our next caller is Tony in Milwaukee. Hello, Tony.
Good morning.
Morning.
I would like to know, get an opinion. I recently retired, and I had my monies in a 401k in the stock market, and then moved them into stable accounts. I guess, as I understand it, stable means usually a low rate of return. Something riskier is high. I'd just like to get your guest's opinion on, once you're retired, you have to have money split up to hedge against inflation. If you could speak to stocks, bonds, and then you know, your traditional safe places for your money. And I just want to get his opinion, and I'll hang up and I'll listen to his answer.
All right. Kevin, you don't have any follow-ups for Tony?
I guess not.
Okay.
Well, and of course, this is, your mileage may vary, and it depends on the individual person. But generally, inflation is not the biggest risk to retirees' financial security. big, ginormous losses to their assets are the biggest risk, and especially at a time when you're not going to earn the money back and you are drawing down the portfolio. It's bad enough to have a 20 or 30% loss to the value of your investments. It's worse to do it when you're drawing money from those accounts because it exacerbates the losses because you're taking a larger percentage of the money out every single month, let's say, as the value goes down. So I am not a big fan of putting beating inflation ahead of preservation of principal for most investors who are retired. Now, some people say I'm going to live a long time. I have a 30-year horizon, and if I don't, I don't care if it's down. I'm not sure I agree with that, but I understand why people would come from that. And we've talked about this before. One thing I'd like a lot of people in Tony's position to think about is that if you have, let's say, a 5-year investment frame where you're kind of thinking about, okay, I'm going to do this for 5 years and see what happens. And you find an investment that pays you 3% every single year guaranteed. And then you have another option that you already know in advance will pay you 10% the first year, 10% the second year, lose 20% the third year, and then make you 10% the fourth year and 10% the fifth year. Well, the first one, the 3% per year, that pays you an annualized rate of return of 3%. The one that goes up and down like crazy and you have to ride it out and you get lots of gains and lots of losses, that makes you 3.2% per year. And that's only if you ride that out after the 20% loss, which if you are retired, that's very difficult for many people to do, to stick around for that next big bump. So generally hanging on to what you have and trying to make a little on it is better than risking it and taking the chance that you may lose 20 to 30% of it. So again, I'd rather have people err on the side of caution, especially in these times and with asset prices where they are.
Tony, thanks very much and good luck to you. Jane in Chippewa Falls is with us now. Hi, Jane.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have a question about my husband is 65 this month and he's working full time and is wondering if it would be if he should take out Social Security, apply for the benefits, or should he wait until he retires?
Jane, do you know if he's contributing to his at-work retirement plan?
Yes, he is. He's maximum amount of his 401k.
Okay, and you are not working outside the home?
Correct.
Okay, but you are not making a spousal Roth IRA or IRA contribution based on his earnings?
No, we do take out an IRA at the end of the year.
Okay. Do you need the money, or is it a case where he just says, you know what, I hear all the time that Social Security is going broke, I don't know how long I'm going to be around, and I want to make sure I get what I can, I just want to take it and go from there?
We don't need the money, and I think I've heard you say before that, you know, it's better to wait, but the Social Security office keeps calling him and insisting that he should take it. He's entitled to those benefits.
Oh, my gosh.
Are you sure they're calling you saying take the money and not something about, you know, perhaps a Medicare enrollment?
No.
Okay. Wow. And I'd check and make sure if it's someone who calls and says, yeah, this is Gary from the, what do you call
Security.
It, the Social Security office.
That's not probably
your money?
Not. Yeah, that's probably not the
probably
Social
Security. Now, I would be adverse to taking it in this case. Normally when people are retiring, like I say in Tony's case, our previous caller, I would say get what you can while you can in most situations. But every year that you can afford to wait to take Social Security in your situation not only lowers the amount of taxes that you will pay on your Social Security because that's going to be added on to his income and he's going to pay probably a good deal of taxes on it, but every year that you wait gives you generally an 8% rise. And plus, I'm guessing his benefit is going to be higher than yours, Jane. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. Assuming because he's male and because we bear all the stress and burdens of the world, we die sooner and you survive him, the check that then he is getting, which is larger, is going to go to you, which is then going to help you in your widowhood if things go according to actuarial plans. So offhand, if he says, you know what, I just want this money, I have things I'd like to do with it, and I just want to get it started, great. But on a financial basis, I'd say tell him to wait until he actually does retire.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane, and good luck to both of you. And time now for Tate in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Tate.
Good morning.
Morning.
Kevin, I have a question for you about those Christmas trees. Is it okay if I go to my neighbor's house?
Yes. As long as they don't find out about it, Tate, it's a victimless crime, the way I see it, okay? Trees are evergreen. They keep growing back and forth. You're helping. You may be removing a tree that's blocking a really nice view for them. So, yeah, I mean, especially if you leave a little, like a half dozen chocolate chip cookies and say, thanks for the tree, your neighbor. I mean, I think that's fair.
Good idea.
It calls it even.
Excellent. I'll do it this year. I actually, though, have a question about my mortgage. I have a unique house. It is 16-sided. And while I can get an appraisal for it when I'm looking to do a refi, the little white, or the people with the little white shirts that sit behind closed doors who evaluate what I'm worth and what they should lend me will not give me a loan because they can't find a comparable to my house in the small town I live in. So I'm wondering, you know, where can I look for a mortgage? Where can no one will touch me? I just, I'm at 5 7/8, and I know I could do a lot better. Help me.
I'm glad you said little white shirts. I thought you were going to say the little white people. And most of the people who work at banks, credit unions are not. Many of them are not little, and many of them are not white. So I'm glad you got that. Yeah, that's a tough one. I would. I'd say so. You did get an appraisal that put a value on it, correct?
Yes.
Okay, but then did you go to another bank or credit union to see what they would have to say?
Several.
Okay, all in the general
one in town. Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay, keep going. The bad news is the further afield that you go to look for a loan, the more likely it is that the interest rates and the fees that you would incur are going to make it difficult for you to offset the reduction in interest. And it's a difficult place to get. Did you build the house or did you buy the house?
No, I bought it.
You bought it. Okay. Did you get a pretty good deal on it when you bought it?
I did, yes.
Okay, well, this is one of the reasons, because the other guy was like, "Geez, I can't borrow money to get on this." And this is, you went back to your original lender to get to try to get a refi, correct?
Well, that's an interesting story. They're not there anymore. They were, it starts with a C. They were kind of big, and they kind of got in some trouble because they just gave away money to anybody.
Yeah. Well, and they also put mortgages on 16-sided houses. That was another issue that they
exactly.
had, too.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. It's a different. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Joe.
No, go ahead, Kevin.
It's a different environment right now. And before, where you, if you had, you know, a tent and a heartbeat, you could get a 30-year mortgage. And now they really are more worried about it. And it's not just the banks trying to be mean or make more money. The regulators are going in and slamming them on every single questionable loan that they've made in the past or thinking about making. So there's a natural apprehension for it.
Right.
I would keep going. I would go to some of the national places and see, like a Lending Tree. You could try for an individual financing, but that's a pretty, try to get what they call peer-to-peer lending, meaning you find an individual who maybe will do it. But a lot of times people who say, you know what, if the bank won't lend you the money at this certain rate, I can't do it either. One thing I would say is as annoying as that interest rate is, I would pay that mortgage down as slowly as possible because of your difficulties getting a new mortgage. It's good to have the cash on hand. And so if something does come up, I'm guessing the house represents a decent portion of your net worth. And I'd like to see you have as much cash on hand from that now rather than paying it off and then go through even more dire consequences if you try to get a new mortgage and have to refinance. Will they at least give you a home equity line of credit against the accumulated equity or not?
I don't believe so. I just burned my second mortgage.
Okay. Did you pay it off or just burn it?
Yeah, I paid it.
Okay, good. That's a good idea.
Tate, I'm just curious. I mean, you're happy with your 16-sided house? And
I love my little cupcake house, yes.
So that it looks like a cupcake?
It does.
Huh.
It's two-story and, traditional construction, and it's a nice house.
Mm-hmm. There's 16 sides to every story of the house, too.
As long as you can deal with pie-shaped bedrooms, you're doing fine.
Interesting.
Yeah, I would say go back and see if you can at least get a home equity line of credit or a home equity loan. You might have a better shot of that rather than refinancing the standard mortgage. And just keep going. Sooner or later, you will find somebody who will help you out for it. But it does take a lot of work, and you're going to have to start going online, I think, to see if you can... especially when you have the appraisal for it. having that appraisal in hand really makes a big difference. Now, of course, the lender is going to send out their appraiser as well, but having one that you've shown, no, people will actually give this an appraised value on it is encouraging.
Thanks very much, Tate, for the call, and good luck to you. I have to love to see that house sometime in Sturgeon Bay. Time for Smart Assets, Kevin. The end of the year is 6 weeks away, and it's a good time to figure out what we can do to cut what we'll owe in taxes come April 15th. So there are some things that we can do.
Yeah, absolutely. And really, we have even less time than the 6 weeks because there aren't many options that many people have at their disposal. Plus, yes, it's 6 weeks until the end of the year, but you've got the holidays and the weekends, et cetera, and people going on vacation. And if you need some help at some office or bank someplace, it's even more difficult and you have an even less time to do it. But we have five moves that many people can make. And we'll also talk about not only what those moves are, but who would be best served by these moves.
All right. So we have a top five list. No drum roll, but give us item number one.
Well, first of all, if you have any room at all and you can still do it, start withholding a little bit more from your paycheck at work into a 401k or 403b or TSA. You can contribute generally up to $16,500 per year and $22,000 if you're over 50 years old. And even if you can just set aside, say, another $1,000 between now and the end of the year, that will cut your income tax bill next April 15th by $200 to $300. And if you say, well, I want to do that because I'm going to use up, that I need that money every single month, it's worth it to dip into your savings and use your savings to offset the expenses until next year and then put it back down to where you were and where you were comfortable. But it's such a great way to get an almost instant 20 to 30% theoretical return on your investment. This is best for people in an upper income bracket. Those are people who generally make about $50,000 a year if they're single filers and twice that if they're married filing jointly. And keep in mind, even if you can't contribute any more or you don't want to between now and the end of the year, you still can make a tax-deductible IRA contribution if you qualify before April 15th of next year.
Okay, I will try to do that. And what else should I do? Reason number two.
Take your losses. If you have any investments in mutual funds that are held outside of an IRA or a Roth IRA and they've gone down versus what you paid for them originally, sell them now. Take the loss, and you get to work it, first of all, against any capital gains you've realized and would otherwise pay taxes on. And second of all, you can work it against your ordinary income up to $3,000 per year. So let's say you made $100,000 of taxable income. You sell something that you lost $3,000 on. They'll only tax you like you made $97,000. And on that $3,000 less income, you'll save about $600 to $1,000 in taxes. And you can buy the investment back in 30 days. You have to wait at least 30 days before or after you sell it to repurchase the investment. But you've not only will have it at a higher basis, which means you'll have lower future gains, but this is also best for people who are in the upper income tax bracket because those in the 15% bracket or lower generally don't pay any capital gains taxes.
Okay. Think about that. It seems like kind of a headache, but when you said it was for upper income, then I realized that's why I'm not used to doing something like that. Number three tax move?
You can make a deposit to the EdVest College Savings Plan. Wisconsin residents can use any plan they want, but the EdVest Wisconsin plan gives a state tax income deduction for deposits up to $3,000 per deposit per person per year. So you can deposit for yourself, you can deposit for a relative, and the relative, it's not just limited to immediate family. Aunts and uncles can get the deduction as well. So let's say a grandmother wants to put $3,000 aside for each one of her three grandchildren. She will save about $300 to $500 in state income taxes if she uses the EdVest plan. Plus, the future earnings are deferred. They're tax-free if they're used for qualified higher education expenses sometime in the future, and the owner can keep total control over the money. So even if you're opening this up for a grandchild or a niece or some kind of relative, you can still remain the owner of the account and do whatever you want with it. You just will pay a slight penalty on the earnings and taxes if you don't use it for qualified higher education expenses. You can find out more information at edvest.com, E-D-V-E-S-T. com, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
And what is move number four that we can take?
This is something all homeowners can and possibly should do. Prepay your property taxes. This is especially good for homeowners who itemize. Bunch your property tax payments. And if you have one that's due, say, on January 1st or January 31st of next year, see if you can prepay it this year and bunch all your deductions along with these property taxes together in the same calendar tax year and itemize this year. And then next year, you'll have less payments, less itemizable deductions. Then you take the standard deduction, and it's a good way to make sure that you go over the threshold and get a large enough dollar amount of deductible expenses so that you can itemize and then do the standard one next year.
Mm-hmm. And finally, number five.
This is becoming something that's a much bigger issue, and it will get even more so. Take your required minimum distribution. That's from an IRA or retirement plan. Obviously, anyone who's over 70 and a half has to take an annual distribution that is taxable every single year. And it might be you or it might be an older relative. The reason it's so important that people get this money out is if you don't take out the required minimum distribution, the IRS can impose a 50% excise tax on the money that should have been taken out and wasn't, and you still have to take it out and pay taxes on the amount. So if you were supposed to take out $5,000 and you don't, you'll hit with a $2,500 excise tax, and then you still have to take the $5,000 out and still pay taxes on it. This is especially important also for people who have inherited IRAs from someone and don't know or don't remember that they were supposed to take this out. But people who are over 70 and a half and do have an IRA, there still is the provision this year where they can channel their required minimum distribution from their IRA directly to a qualified charity, and it's tax-free. And it's important because many people in that situation do not itemize. So instead of writing a check to your church or Wisconsin Public Radio or the American Cancer Society, see if you can have your RMD from your IRA sent directly to the charity, and then you don't have to itemize, but you don't have to pay taxes on the distribution.
Good advice. Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC, and time for a few calls. Sheila in Onalaska is with us. Hello, Sheila.
Hi. Hi.
Yes, go ahead, Sheila.
I'm 66 years old, so I really need to find a financial planner, and I've gone to several, maybe five or six over the last 10 years, but they all want to put any money that I have in whatever they sell, you know, Pacific or some other. They require that you invest in whatever they sell.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to find someone that would go into no loaded funds, but I'm having, or just charge a one-time fee, and I'm having a lot of trouble finding somebody.
Sure. Thankfully, we are very few and far between, and I don't begrudge those advisors for, you know, wanting to earn money and earn a living. That's how they get paid. Generally, people in a traditional brokerage house or investment advisory office get paid on commission. And those commission products are perfectly fine as long as you understand the cost and you are willing to enter in that kind of model. But you're not, of course, forced to do that. There are some, not many. I wish there were more, but there aren't many fee-based advisors around. But we have a couple websites where you can search for one who is a truly fee-based advisor and will charge you for on an hourly basis or on a flat percentage of your assets to manage the assets and not charge you any commission to buy and sell it as well. And it does open up a wider spectrum of investments when it is just fee-based, and it means that you generally will pay less over time, and you're hopefully getting more service because the advisor doesn't get paid anymore if you fire him or her because you're not happy with what they're doing for you. But you can also, Sheila, get a pretty good low-cost, you know, you get what you pay for, but this is a better value in my mind than, you know, paying someone a bunch of commission and then they either don't serve you or they don't serve you as well as you hoped. By going to a place like Fidelity or Schwab or Vanguard or USAA.com, they'll do investment recommendations for you. It's generally at a lower cost. And yes, you know, they have a bias slightly towards their own investments, but most of them are pretty good at saying, you know, we're not perfect and this is a good one or not. But you generally will find that you'll pay less for dealing with those kinds of firms. You are going to get less help, and you're probably going to be doing it online and over the phone versus in person. But it is an option for people who say, I don't want to pay a lot for this. I don't need a lot of help, but I need some kind of advice. So one of those kind of outfits might be able to help you in a way that you're more interested in.
Did you say, Kevin, there is a website you can go to look for the
fee-based planners? Yeah, it's fpanet.org is one, and then I think napfa.org is one, too. And again, we'll put those up at onyourmoney.com later on today.
All right. Good luck to you, Sheila. Thanks for calling. Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC. Our number, if you have a question for Kevin, is 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Coming up, we'll take more of your calls, and we also will talk about whether it is a good idea or not to purchase extra warranty protection on electronics that might be on your holiday list. This is On Your Money on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Better shop around. Oh, yeah, better shop around. Well, if you are shopping around for electronics as a gift or maybe for yourself, should you purchase extended warranties? We'll talk with certified financial planner Kevin McKinley about that. So, Kevin, what do you say? Should we get that extra warranty protection?
Well, I actually like the notion of separating the warranty from the product, the extended warranty, meaning that people who want to get this extended coverage can decide if it's right for them and they want to own it, and people who don't get to pay less for the product than they otherwise would. But it's very annoying, and it's almost kind of heartbreaking when you're going through the big box retailer and you slide this up, then they say, would you like to purchase advanced protection for only $9.90 a month? And, no, thank you. Would you sure? And I understand that that person not only has to do that to keep their job, but he or she can earn a little bit of commission by if I agree to do that. I just as soon actually, slip them a couple bucks and say, look, I know you're going to make $3 if I buy this. So here's three ones. I don't have to have the warranty. You get your money and let's just call this even. But they frown upon that. Their supervisors don't like that. When that person asks that question, ask them, can I think about this or do I have to make a decision right now? Because there are a lot of other options if you want it at all. And quite frankly, there's a simpler and usually less expensive solution than going out and spending the extra money on the warranty.
Such as?
Well, first of all, your credit card may already offer some form of coverage if you buy the item in question with the credit card in question. Amex, the American Express cards are really good, have a great wire-to-wire protection on a lot of different products and services, and it's not just about extending the manufacturer's warranty. It's about your satisfaction with it. Visa and MasterCard have generally less comprehensive coverage, but they do have coverage in many different cases. And a lot of times they'll add it on to the manufacturer's warranty or they'll broaden the coverage on top. But again, check with the card provider first to see if the item is actually covered. And if it means that you put it on the credit card and you don't pay off the balance right away, the interest cost that you incur fairly quickly is going to be more than the cost of the warranty. So if you are going to use the credit card for that purpose, pay it off right away and avoid the interest charges.
What if my credit card is in that bowl of frozen water in the freezer?
Oh, that's right.
And what if I just prefer to pay with cash or a debit card? Then what?
You can actually buy coverage elsewhere. You don't have to buy it through the seller or through the manufacturer. You can get it. Many insurance companies are starting to offer new types of coverage on larger items like electronics, iPads, et cetera, computers. And then SquareTrade is an extended warranty seller, a third-party extended warranty seller that gets generally very good reviews from its users in terms of being helpful but also charging less than what the manufacturer or the retailer would charge for a similar extended warranty. SquareTrade is a neat deal if you are buying a refurbished item. A lot of times you see people who have returned electronics, it's still at the factory. The old people got a new product, but they just fixed the old one. It's refurbished, and it's quite a bit cheaper. A lot of times if you put the SquareTrade warranty on top of that, you still save some money, but you get protection in case the same thing or something else goes wrong. Again, make sure you read the fine print of it before you buy it, and then keep it handy afterwards.
So do you have a better alternative to extended warranties?
Yes. Use the one that comes with the product. There still is a warranty with the product. And generally, if something is going to go wrong with these above and beyond normal wear and tear, it's going to happen fairly quickly while the manufacturer's warranty is still in place. And even when you do have that warranty coverage, there's the time and hassle of sending it in, trying to make sure they track it, being on hold with customer service forever, especially post-holidays when everybody's having issues with this. And then, having the loss of the item while you're waiting for it to be ostensibly repaired. So instead, a better idea is to save the money that would otherwise go into the purchasing the extended warranty, put it into an isolated account, call it my warranty account or whatever, and every time you buy an item, ask them what the extended warranty would cost, put the cash in there, and then when your item inevitably does break down, use whatever cash you've accumulated in there to go out and buy the same used item on eBay or in some kind of secondary market on Craigslist, and you'll pay way less for it. Many of these electronics items generally depreciate at a rate of 50% per year, so they really have a half-life over a year in terms of value, and a lot of times you can buy the same version that that just broke on you for pennies on the dollar on what you paid for the new one. So just use the money you would have spent on the warranty just to buy a new one. And again, most of these products actually don't break down, and you'll find yourself glad that you put the money aside for other uses.
Sounds good. Kevin McKinley, Certified Financial Planner, Managing Member of McKinley Money, LLC. Our number, if you have a question for Kevin, is 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to onyourmoney@wpr.org. Jim in Shatek is with us. Hello, Jim.
Hi. I have a question for Kevin. I've got a, I'm 62 this year, or in January, and I have a pension at another company that I worked at. And I'm wondering if I should take that pension now while I'm still working, or if that's going to cause me excess tax issues. The problem is that I'm going to be taking a pay cut, and I'm looking for a way to increase my bottom line, so to speak, to keep me even.
Yeah, the pension, you're talking about taking a lump sum or a monthly pension payment?
That'd be a monthly pension payment.
Yeah, that's taxable income, but definitely take that. And it's a private pension, like from it's not a government pension, right?
No.
Okay. I would definitely have you take that. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Generally, it's a good idea for people to wait to take either pensions or Social Security, especially if you think you're going to live past the age of 78 or 79. That's where most actuarial tables have a cutoff that say, look, if you make it past this age, you'll end up ahead by waiting, no matter if you're waiting from 55 to 60 or 60 to 65. However, and especially in the case of a private pension, many retirees who are counting on that pension money in the future are going to be disappointed because many of the pensions are using very high expectations for investment returns to almost pretend that they're fully funded. It's legal for them to do this because the consultants say that they can, but they pay those consultants. So I would rather have you get that pension money while you can, especially when you need it, rather than holding off for some hope down the road that it's going to be there and be there in a higher amount. This way you get it in your hand, and once you get that check, they can't take it away from you.
Okay. And then, do you know, will that just add to my total income and I would just pay tax on it like regular income?
Yeah, it is fully taxable, but one way you can handle that if you can afford to do this, let's say you're going to get $1,000 a month from this pension, then defer $1,000 from your current income per month into your at-work 401k, and you'll end up getting all the money in your hand right away, but not having it grow your tax bill whatsoever, because when you defer the money into your 401k, you obviously, that's your own money, and nobody can take that away from you. You can gain and lose on it, but it's still your own money. So that's one way to do it. But then again, many times in this situation, people can't afford to forego that extra $1,000 a month in your 401k. But take your pension check and then offset it in a similar amount in your at-work retirement plan or in a tax-deductible IRA, and then you won't have to pay taxes on the amount, at least for the time being.
Thanks very much, Jim, and good luck to you. Thanks for calling. Jennifer in Milwaukee is with us now. Hello, Jennifer.
Hi. I have a question about the paying your property taxes in advance and wondering, I've always used TurboTax to do my tax filings, and if I pay my property taxes in advance, will I still be able to use TurboTax to itemize all my goodwill contributions and things like that for that future year when you said to take the standard deduction?
Well, for better or for worse, Jennifer, what people should do, and it sounds weird, we're not programmed to think like this, but all of the things that you do that allow you itemized deductions should all be done in the year in which you can itemize. And meaning that if, let's say, you give $100 a year to a qualified charity, well, you might want to think about giving $200 in one year to the qualified charity in the year in which you itemize, and then nothing the next year, and just say, sorry, I'm taking the standard deduction this year, so I don't want to contribute it. So it's about bunching your deductions. And the standard deduction is pretty high for many people. It's going up close to $12,000 for married couples filing jointly next year, and about half that amount for single filers. So you do have to have a lot of itemizable deductions. Thankfully, Wisconsin is a tax that, or a state that has a high value of property taxes relative to our income and housing. So many people use their property taxes as the primary source to get over that threshold and get their deductions. You have to watch out for the alternative minimum tax a little bit as well. But yes, you do want to itemize in 1 year and then take the standard next year. And don't try to avoid doing all your donations in the year you take the standard deduction. It'll still be a nice gesture to the organization, but you won't get the tax break on it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks. I'm sorry, Kevin. Why wouldn't we want to itemize if you can every year?
If you can, great. Mm-hmm. But many people are on the border of where they don't have enough itemized deductions in a given year to use it. So you're better off trying to bunch them and then itemize and take those deductions in one calendar tax year. And then the next year, just use the standard because it would exceed what your other itemizable deductions are.
I get it. Jeff in Beloit is with us now. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. My question for Kevin is, my wife is ill. She's about to have her second brain surgery. I don't believe she's going to be able to work. And so I want to sign her up for disability. I understand that's a lengthy process to finally get a check. My question is, can we tap into her 403B with no penalty? She's 55 years old if she is not working.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that. And you are doing the right thing. If you need to get the money, get the money. And yes, you can get at a 403B without a penalty under these circumstances, generally reimbursing any uncovered medical expenses. You can get a hardship withdrawal, and that avoids the penalty. And then there are also ways. I'm sorry, Jeff, you said she's over 55?
She is 55.
She's 55. Okay. Then there are ways that you can get at that money without paying a penalty, even if it is for just living expenses. Now, you are still going to pay taxes on it. That is almost impossible to avoid, but it's just taxable income. I'm guessing she's not working right now because you're applying for disability, right?
She's working part-time right now, but her surgery is going to be coming up, and after this, I don't believe she'll be able to go back to work.
Okay, well, here's one thing I would say. If you can make it 6 more weeks on this, try to get the withdrawal done in the calendar tax year of 2012 because it's more likely that your income is going to be lower because it's less likely that she's going to be working and adding to it. So not only will you be able to hopefully avoid the penalties on it, but your taxes will be lower because your income will be lower if you can push the withdrawal out into 2012. Or if you do have to take it out this year, Jeff, just take it out enough to get you to the end of the year and then take the lion's share out next year. And again, you should be able to avoid it for several reasons. And I'll tell you what, if you get a chance, send an email to me at kevin@onyourmoney.com, and I'll give you a couple other things that you want to think about in this situation.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, Jeff. Yeah, good luck to you. Thanks for calling. So, Kevin, we do have time for the website of the week.
Well, one of the big issues that people lose out on money with purchasing warranties and even taking advantage of a manufacturer's warranty is they forget not only what the warranty was, but what they did with it when they bought it. So warrantyelephant.com. Warrantyelephant.com is a free service where you can log in and put in all of your different purchases that you have in there. You could even scan in your sales receipts and the warranty, and then warrantyelephant.com will send you an email reminding you, saying, hey, you've got 6 months left until this warranty expires. You've got 3 months left until it expires, etc. So you can not only keep all the information in one place, but it is free. It's a nifty little site, warrantyelephant.com, and we'll have a link up to that website at our website, onyourmoney.com, later on today.
That sounds good. So is the fake or the real tree going up soon, or do you wait until after the Thanksgiving feast?
I'm guessing this is a Thanksgiving project, but yes, I'm sorry, National Association of Christmas Tree Growers. I love fresh cut trees and everything, but we don't have the time or the energy, and quite frankly, I enjoy being married, and I found that both getting and taking down the Christmas tree is a major stress point in our marriage, and I don't want to push it any further than we already have.
I think they'll forgive you for that. Kevin, thanks very much for being with us. Four more words before we go.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley is a certified financial planner, managing member of McKinley Money, LLC, with offices in Eau Claire and in Madison. He will be with us next week for another edition of On Your Money. Thanks to Rob Ferret and to Bill Martins for producing this program. Thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. And I hope you join us tomorrow at this time. We will talk about distracting and disrupting our brains and how that can actually help us focus on thinking. We'll talk with the author of Now You See It tomorrow morning between 8 and 9. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.